We'll start back up. Public hearing on Senate Bill 5514 regarding the Government Standards and Practices Commission budget, and we'll proceed with public testimony. Let's see, Mr. Bishop? Is Mr. Patterson going to be in? Okay, all right. He had asked me about it, and I didn't know. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm an attorney in the Salem office of Harang Long Jerry Rudnick. I'm a registered lobbyist, and I'm here as a board member for the Capital Club. The Capital Club is the professional association of lobbyists in Oregon. In the architecture profession, I'm told they have an axiom that form follows function. And I suspect that the corollary of that in a bureaucracy is that forms follow functions. I would suggest to the subcommittee, in all due respect, that in some instances the forms of the Government Standards and Practices Commission do not, in fact, track with its functions. And that is the source of the issues that I would like to discuss with the subcommittee this afternoon. 2 months ago, in response to proposed administrative rules, I testified before the commission on its rule proposal, and I've submitted to the subcommittee for your general background information a copy of that testimony. I won't be going through that in any detail with you. Many of the issues that I've identified in the written testimony are technical and semantic issues. However, I do think there are a couple of significant issues that are worth bringing to the subcommittee's attention as you deliberate the budget for the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Let me talk about two main issues that we have identified in the proposed rules. First of all, we have a concern with the registration and the reporting requirements that the Government Standards and Practices Commission is currently using. We believe that those requirements are at best confusing to lobbyists who are trying their best to comply with the requirements of the law. Let me give you an example of the problems that we think exist with the current requirements. A lobbyist is required to register with the commission in the event that the lobbyist engages in lobbying activities for more than 24 hours a quarter or spends more than $100 on lobbying activities. In addition, a lobbyist is required to register with the commission for any specific client interest that the lobbyist represents. And it's those two obligations that it seems to me are in conflict. Whether the duty to register is for the individual lobbyist, myself as a lobbyist, or if it's for each lobbyist and each lobbyist's individual clients. The reason that becomes a conflict, I believe, is because it is the commission's current practice to expire registrations automatically after 2 years. And it's not clear to me, and I may be the only one who's confused about it, but it's not clear to me when that 2 years starts, if it's for the first client for whom one is registered, or if it is renewed as subsequent clients are added on and just continues from the latest 2 year registration. That, I think, becomes a problem for us as a lobbyist profession trying to maintain conformance with the requirements. And that's an area in which it seems to me the proposed rules don't clarify the reporting obligations, and we have recommended that the rules be changed. The additional specific problem in the registration area stems from the fact that the commission's forms ask lobbyists to disclose who their employers are. In my situation, my employer is the law firm of Harang Long Jerry Rudnick, and I lobby for specific clients through that employment relationship. But on the form, I'm requested to disclose who my employer is. And my employer is not Kaiser Permanente. It is not the Coquel tribe. It is not any of the other client interests whom I represent. And it may seem to you obvious that I will register for my clients, and I suspect that that's what the commission expects will be done. But the form itself doesn't actually ask for the right information. And I'm not just hypothesizing about the problem. Since I presented this testimony, I've become aware of a situation where an employee of Kaiser Permanente, who is also a union member, registered on behalf of her union to be a lobbyist on issues of concern to her union. She was asked to disclose who her employer is, and appropriately, she disclosed that Kaiser Permanente is her employer. That's the information that was requested and that she supplied. But the entity for whom she is lobbying is not Kaiser Permanente. It was her labor union who she was advocating on behalf. What that set up in the system then was that the report, the expenditure requirements, the expenditure reporting requirements came to Kaiser Permanente at a clinic address where she happened to work. She didn't receive the report requiring her to indicate what her expenditure activities had been as a lobbyist. Kaiser Permanente didn't know that she was a lobbyist for Kaiser Permanente. And one of her labor officials signed her lobbyist registration. Now, she didn't sign that as a representative of Kaiser Permanente. She signed it as a labor official. But there's confusion there. And I think the confusion is at least compounded and not clarified by the reporting requirements that we are all expected to abide by. That's a fundamental kind of baseline problem, it seems to me, that I'm sure the commission can fix. I hope the commission will fix. But when you start out with inaccurate information there, I think it's possible that those inaccuracies will start to create additional problems throughout the whole system. Those are our concerns with the registration and subsequently with the reporting requirements under the current practices of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. The second point that I want to make with regard to the testimony that we presented on the rules is that last year the Attorney General gave a rather exhaustive opinion about what constitutes lobbying. That was in response to a request by Chris Durth of the Governor's Office, and Mr. Durth was chairing a work group in the Executive Department to look at what was the appropriate role of state agency lobbyists who are advocating for their agencies in this building. As I say, the Attorney General gave exhaustive analysis about what constitutes lobbying for the purposes of state agencies. But in my opinion, at least, because the Attorney General was interpreting statutory provisions that are equally applicable to private lobbyists, not for state agencies, all of those requirements in the opinion apply equally to me as they would apply to any state agency lobbyist. And I think because of the significance of that opinion last year, it's important that the Commission modernize its rules to conform to that opinion. Much of what the Commission has attempted to do in this rulemaking is in that direction. In my opinion, they haven't completed the job yet, though, and I think there are still additional details in their rules that they should make to conform to the Attorney General's advice about what constitutes lobbying. Those definitions become very significant in determining when a lobbyist is required to register and what it is that a lobbyist is required to report in terms of expenditures. And because of the new Attorney General's opinion on what constitutes lobbying, I believe that those need to be incorporated into the rules of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Now you're probably wondering, what does that have to do with the budget? Because this is a Ways and Means Subcommittee, and all you need to do is to provide the money for the agency to continue its work. In the proposed rules, the Government Standards and Practices Commission proposes that it be allowed to levy a $5 per day civil penalty for the late filing of lobbyist for the late filing of lobbyist expenditure and entity expenditure reports. Those are the reports that I file myself as an individual lobbyist and that my clients are required to file annually to indicate how much they have expended on lobbying. Presently, the Commission has the authority to levy civil penalties up to $1,000. This changes that to a $5 per day for delinquent filing requirement. And it seems to me, at least, that that will create potentially a substantial additional workload for the Commission in making sure that it knows when the reports are received, that people are apprised of the delinquency and all of the process that will be required for enforcing and collecting the civil penalties. For the Capital Club, we have not had an opportunity to fully discuss whether a $5 per day civil penalty by the Government Standards and Practices Commission is an appropriate sanction. But it does represent, in our opinion, a substantial change in the practice that the Commission has observed in the past. And we believe it will create an additional workload for the Commission that, as far as we can tell at least, is not now contemplated in the budget that you have before you. For those reasons, we would urge the subcommittee to carefully consider this budget and what changes are going to be made in the Commission's practices over the next 2 years before you approve it for the full committee. I would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. I'm just a little bit vague on the the nexus of the $5 and the total effect upon the budget. If you'll go back over that portion of it with me again.
Mr. Chairman, I will try. The $5, of course, does not go to the Commission itself. It's a civil penalty, and it would revert to the general fund, so it's not part of the Commission's budget in that respect. But it seems to me that changing from a potential civil penalty structure of up to $1,000 to a very specific $5 per day civil penalty for delinquent filings will entail more work for the Commission in tracking what is a delinquent filing. By and large, in the past, I believe, the Commission has not sought to levy civil penalties against either lobbyists or entities who register or retain lobbyists if the filings are late.
The late issue comes in from the time that they should have filed as a lobbyist, and it's difficult to determine when that should be.
The late filing will come from the time that the expenditure reports are due. And those are due for lobbyists on a different cycle depending whether it's in session or out of session, but for entities they are due on an annual basis. So there are both the registration and the reporting requirement issues about who you register for and how that cycles, as well as the expenditure report. So we have two processes in place.
Talking about potentially this duality of the workload creating additional difficulty, the difficulty with the statutory line, or the not statutory, but the administrative rule language. The difficulty with that language then creating actually a burdensome situation to try and calculate or to go back and determine when it should have been filed and then making the computations relative to when the filing date should have been plus a grace period and then the $5 period starts at that point, so you've got more work on. I see.
Yeah, okay. That's the proposal, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Trill is recognized.
Mr. Bishop, have you gotten any response to your February 17th letter to the Standards and Practices Commission? I haven't read that letter, but I think as you described the issues relating to registration and reporting practices, and you probably talked about this this penalty as well. Have they responded back to you in any way that they might be taking action along to remedy some of these things?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trowe, the commission was scheduled to have another meeting on the proposed rules last week. They did not take action on the rules then, and I understand that they will consider further changes to the rules probably next month. So they have not adopted any rule changes yet, but I have not received...
Directly dealing with what you're concerned with?
I have had no indication specifically that they will do that. We have not had a chance either individually or between the Capital Club and the Commission to sit down and talk about these issues to try to mediate them or figure out, you know, where each group is coming from. But I did make the formal presentation to the commission, and I assume that they will take those concerns into consideration.
You made the formal presentation. Was there a give and take afterwards so that you got some idea that they listened to you and they were concerned about what you said?
There was some give and take, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator, for all some questions. Other questions or comments that are relative to Mr. Bishop's testimony? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate you being here. Let's go ahead then, and Mr. Hearn and Mr. Fager, if there's no other public testimony, we'll go back into your portions of the testimony. I guess probably one of the obvious things to do would be to ask if we could clean up or assist in any way with the administrative rules. Is there some anticipation of trying to get these things maybe addressed that it could lighten your workload somewhat?
Mr. Chair, certainly there is, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to respond, and I will be brief. We certainly did, in fact, invite Mr. Bishop to our February meeting, and he addressed the commission, and he provided written comments that you have before you. The commission only meets about every 6 to 7 weeks. I mean, they're late persons with other lives, and so we try to minimize the requirements of commission service for them. We did have a meeting last Thursday, a regular commission meeting, and we did have further consideration of the administrative rulemaking on the agenda. As it turns out, we had numerous cases with council representation, and it just simply ate the time up, and we just ran out of inadequate time. I spoke with Mr. Bishop on the phone on Friday and assured him that our legal counsel and I had gone through his comments, that we were preparing to incorporate those comments into the draft of the rulemaking. We anticipate doing that within the next couple of weeks, and we will then provide him with copies of those, of that work, as well as sending it to our commissioners. So we're on it. We're just a little slower than we'd like to be.
Okay, I appreciate that. I didn't sense that there was any reticence on your part to proceed with that. I just wanted for the record to make sure that there wasn't any difficulty in proceeding with the own administrative rules in that process that you undergo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. We'll get one member back in here, and we can go into a work session. Mr. Fager, Senator Trozier,
could I ask a question about the late filing fee, the $5 a day? This is something new you're doing. You obviously believe there was some sort of problem, and this would be a more effective solution than the previous fee schedule.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, currently there is virtually no compliance hammer, if you will, for filing. You may recall, I believe you were on the Senate Government or Ethics and Elections Committee in 1993 when we enacted the late filing fee for statements of economic interest. And prior to that, there was a very poor compliance. For instance, out of roughly 4,000, there would be 400. The legislature enacted the $5 a day late filing fee, and now we're down to less than 100. And by the and plus that incorporates an approximate 30-day grace period, as I indicated yesterday.
The $5 fee has been around since 93.
Yes, for the statements of economic interest.
Mm-hmm.
So the point I'm trying to make was now compliance is down to when the late penalty starts, probably 40 or 50 is all. So the objective, of course, is to try and achieve a higher level of compliance.
And it's doing that, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trope, in regards to the statements of economic interest, absolutely.
Are you pretty good at notifying people when their registration runs out? That seems to be a problem. Are you required to notify lobbyists, for instance, if his or her registration runs out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trope, we are not required to notify them. And what we do is this. When we send out their expenditure reports, we have a cover letter, an instructional cover letter. And there's a statement in the cover letter that says the date in the upper right-hand corner of the address label on your form is the date your registration expires. That's about the best we can do with our limited staff. What we've been told by many people is they never read the cover letter. So I guess that date goes unseen.
How does it work if somebody registers for one client and then a year and a half later registers for another? Does that person have to re-register in a half year after doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schroll, this actually will be resolved in the rulemaking. And in fact, I was of the belief that we already had had it in our initial draft, but perhaps we didn't. Also legislated in 1993 was a registration fee for lobbyists. And that was challenged in court, and just this past November, the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. It was a $50 fee per lobbyist, but not per lobbyist client. The only way we could make the fee due date gel with the registrations was to make all subsequent registrations expire on the date of the first one, when the fee would have expired. Now, with the fee element gone, it won't be a problem. It'll go away. We'll just make every registration expire 2 years from the date it's received.
Now, you don't have to register for each individual client, or you do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, yes, you do.
Okay, so if, for instance, I registered for that first client, and then a second client a year and a half later, in 6 months I've got to re-register for the first client. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, yes.
Okay, so that's the way it works. Okay, so it's 2 years for each client. It's not just 2 years as a lobbyist, but it's 2 years for each client. You have to register each time for each client.
Mr. Chair, Senator Toll, again, with the lobbyist registration fee not an issue, that's the way it will be now. It will be 2 years for each client from the date that registration is filed.
If I got six clients at different times, I've got to really be on my toes to make sure that I get re-registered for each of those clients.
Mr. Chair,
in the alternative, could each time you re-register, each time you add a new client, you could just go ahead and register for all the prior ones as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schill, yeah.
You can do that.
Yes, and if I may add, many lobbyists who have multiple clients prefer doing it all at the same time. That makes it easier for them to know when they need to do it. That's a choice they ask us if they can make.
So each time you get a new client, let's say I've got six and I get seven, well, then I go in and I register for the seventh client, and then I tie all of them to the same date by re-registering for all of them?
Some of the lobbyists do attempt to do that, yes, Mr. Chair, Senator.
The last time you added a client would begin a new 2-year period.
Yeah, I like that. If they'll let you do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, so we really probably wouldn't encourage that because I think, as you can see, that would greatly enhance our paperwork. And, I mean, if we let's say somebody has 25 clients and they might register 3 or 4 times a year, you know, if we're doing that 3 or 4 times a year unnecessarily, it doesn't make a lot of cost-effective sense to me.
About 25 clients, each time one comes due, you've got to redo this. There's a lot of work that is.
But you don't have to, Senator. Mr. Chair, Senator, no. You don't have to.
Not understanding how it works.
Mr. Bishop, did you have additional comments that you wanted to make relative to the registration client?
I would just point out that it's not my responsibility to register for the client. The client has to sign the form.
Oh.
So it's not something that I can just do for my client. Each client would then have to sign a new authorization.
I see.
On that account. So it becomes more complicated.
Thank you for that explanation. I think there was one other item that we had that was unresolved yesterday, and that was relative to the stock transfers. Did anybody have an opportunity to look at that?
Mr. Chair, I have the answer for you, and I was half right. You recall at the end of that form, there's questions 7, 8, 9, and 10. And you don't have to answer questions 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Unless...
Aid involves an individual or business that did business with or recently could be expected to do business with a public body you serve or over which you have authority, or B, the information requested involves an individual or business with a legislative or administrative interest in the public body you serve or over which you have authority. And on that form, question number 9 says business investment of more than $1,000. If you, a member of your household, had a personal beneficial interest or investment in a business during 1998 of more than $1,000, list, and then note, do not list the amount of the investment, do not list individual items in a mutual fund or blind trust, or a time or demand deposit in a financial institution, shares in a credit union, or the cash surrender value of life insurance. So,
doesn't address stock ownership specifically.
No, does not address it specifically, although I suppose that what a business investment is something that's open to interpretation. But again, you only have to complete those questions if those two criteria apply.
But the business investment with corporate, with your own corporate family, corporate stock, or closely held corporate stock, is taken care of much earlier in the form,
right,
as I recall.
It is.
So,
the key to this, Mr. Chair, in my view, is what it says that can be expected to do business with the public body you represent. Now, I may or may not own stock in a company that may approach the state of Oregon to do business. I have no clue. So what am I supposed to do? I could possibly check. I own a couple of stocks right now, but I have no idea if they do any business. They're small cap companies. They may not do any business in the state of Oregon ever. But I don't know. So what do I do? I mean, I may trade hundreds of stocks in a year because I'm a day trader. I trade every few days. What do I do? I mean, do I have to provide all the reporting documents and make copies of that?
I have a friend who's a day trader. He works at the soup kitchen now.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you're not careful day trading, that's where you'll be, too, standing in line in the soup kitchen.
It may not be an issue by next
time. Wow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I think the key is, in the phraseology, it involves an individual or business that did business with or reasonably could be expected to. If there's no indication on the horizon, if there's absolutely no reason to anticipate that entity is going to do business, I don't think it would create a problem for a public official.
But if I had specific knowledge that Dell Computer was dealing with the Secretary of State's division for a huge computer purchase, and I purchased stock with that thought in mind that this could be a very lucrative deal for Dell, their stock prices, their earnings will go up, their stock prices will go up, then that would be a case where that would be, in fact, an issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I would agree.
Thank you very much.
Will Lurk.
Yes.
That's been Hessen's recognized?
I didn't have this time in this conversation yesterday, but wouldn't it be prudent to, if you had any doubt, just to list all of your investments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meserly, that's my opinion, yes. The conservative approach is always the best approach. You're not going to get caught that way. Or surprised.
And if your broker buys stock after the form is filled out, would it be prudent to upgrade your... notify your office?
Mr. Chair, Representative Medley, I don't believe so. Not after the form's out. That would probably be appropriate for the following year's form.
It's an annual form through the prior December 31st. That's our point. I think we did touch base on that yesterday. We said it was something like a prenuptial agreement. That is, if you
think it might be there, or if they ever had the possibility of being there, you probably ought to go ahead and list it at that point. Okay, we'll go into the work session at this point then, and we'll have Mr. Steve Binder go ahead and Bender. Steve Bender, ladies and gentlemen.
Just step outside for a moment when you're ready to vote.
Yeah.
You have something else to do the work.
Can I get a pitch for you? Okay, too. I'm getting ready.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've distributed to you some information on the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendations on this budget. I've distributed three sheets, and I'd like to look at the one that I distributed on top, which is a verbal description of what we recommend is that the subcommittee adopts as a budget for the Government Standards and Practices Commission. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the committee adopt the 1999 governor's recommended budget for the agency with the following changes. There are four of them, four changes that we recommend that you consider and adopt. If you look at the table here, the spreadsheet page that I've also distributed, the second page of that spreadsheet shows numerically the impact of the four recommendations by LFO. The first recommendation is merely that you approve a technical adjustment to reduce the Attorney General charges for the agency by $413 in general funds and by $193 in other funds. This is a very small adjustment numerically, but it reflects changes in the hourly rate that will be charged by the Department of Justice for Attorney General fees. That rate is going to be increased this biennium to $90 an hour. When the governor put together the budgets for all agencies, that was based on the $92 per hour rate. So this will reflect that reduction, and you will be, or you should be, finding this LFO recommendation for every agency, the standard 2.6% cut for every agency that has Attorney General charges in their budget. The second recommendation deals with the package that the governor proposed, which is number 200 in the governor's budget, for computers and year 2000 compliance. The governor had proposed $32,400, and on the first sheet, the one that I haven't referred to yet, there's a sheet, a one-page sheet that says Government Standards and Practices Commission, package 200. LFO recommends that you approve this package, but at a reduced level. And I'd like to, if I spend a few minutes to get into a little more detail here as to what this package is funding, and how it was priced in the governor's recommended budget. What the package includes is a new personal computer for each of the four personnel in the agency that would be year 2000 compliant and be able to run the software that the state is using, the Microsoft Office suite. They price this at each of these computers is $2,500 each for a cost of $10,000. LFO is recommending or believes that given the decline in prices for personal computers since the time when this package was priced by the Department of Administrative Services, who by the way came up with these numbers, this is not the agency who developed these numbers. These particular cost amounts were developed by the Department of Administrative Services. We believe that you could fund these at essentially $2,200 per computer for a savings of $1,200. This is not a scientific analysis, and I did not go through any, I have to be honest, I did not go through any type of looking at prices or anything like that. This is just to reflect reductions in prices, since these prices were put together, I believe it was in last November. We also are recommending a 10% cut in the amount that the government recommended for other hardware systems. That includes a server, a dedicated server, and the software associated with that. We're recommending a reduction of $300 or 10% there. 10% in the cabling and hub systems to establish a local area network to connect the four computers in the office with the server. We have a 10% reduction recommended in funding for a new laser printer and for the modems, two modems that will be used in the system. We are not recommending any cuts. There was a funding here. The agency will now need a fifth telephone line, or I should say one additional telephone line for the internet access. We're not recommending any reductions in the $1,000 that was budgeted for that. The next item is a charge by the Information Resources Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services, a charge that they will be levying to the agency to set up their new computers and to get the LAM started. The Department of Administrative Services had asked for $2,500, and we are recommending that that be reduced to $1,675. We know that the Information Resources Management Division receives funding from service charges for services for the activities that it engages in, including setting up a system like this. But we do not believe that a job of this nature would actually require that division to hire additional personnel in order to accomplish this job. So we believe that part of the cost could be borne by the larger budget of IRMD, the Information Resources Management Division. The proposal includes $10,000 for website development, that is to hire someone, it's a professional services, to hire someone to help develop the Government Standards and Practices Commission's website. We are recommending, because of budgetary restrictions, that be reduced and that perhaps the website might not have everything at this time that could have been developed at a $10,000 rate, but we do believe that they could establish a functioning and useful website with less in professional services. We recommend a 10% cut in training for the office on website management, how to manage their website, and how to use the capital office in that line refers to the Microsoft Office suite of software. And we do not recommend any reductions to the $1,200 that was in the budget for email and internet access connectivity. The governor's budget, as it was introduced, would have cost $33,000, though in the budget itself, they only included $32,400. I think I'm not sure what the discrepancy was, but looking at the funding levels that legislative fiscal is recommending, we would recommend funding the package of $27,345, which is a reduction of $5,055 from the amount that is in the governor's budget. It's not a reduction from the amount, the $33,000 that we have listed there, but it's the actual reduction from the amount that is printed in the governor's budget. Finally,
Do
you mind if I go out and ask these folks if they can manage this with us? Not
no, that would be fine.
Okay, what do you think? Can you stretch your bucks to do all of this with these cuts here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troy, I can do my best. I appreciate the thought and the consideration that went into these recommendations. I mean, there's certainly some rationale in these various line items. It wasn't just an across-the-board
weeks. And in package 200, you know no reason why you can't do this, except that you know it's going to be tight and you have to stretch. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Turley, yes.
Okay.
That's all my questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Turley. Please proceed, Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair, members, going back to this spreadsheet here, the next recommendation that we're making is that you reduce funding for inflation on goods and service expenses in the budget by $4,000. And I would like to explain this a little bit. If you could please turn to the front page of this two-page spreadsheet. In the middle of the front page, where it says 1999-01 budget development, you can see the adjustments that are included in this budget for from what was approved during the 97-99 biennium to get to the governor's recommendation. And you can look down at those items. The 43,000, I'm just looking at the general fund column here, the $43,757 and the $18,895 all represent changes in personnel costs. And we do not recommend making any adjustments there. So similarly, the $7,684 in vacancy factor and the $334 represent personnel cost changes. What that leaves is $4,953 increase to cover inflation and the cost of the goods and services that the agency is buying, and $27,858 in changes in government service charges, primarily to allow the government, in the current budget, they were not funded for their full charges, and this would restore that. When the agency was asked to respond to 4% budget cuts, the executive director, and quite appropriately, identified these cuts by the type of line item. Our recommendation, though, to this committee is that we believe that the agency is well managed, and that rather than attempting to make reductions by line item, that we allow the agency to manage within that, but in the interest of meeting revenue requirements and the amount of revenue availability, that you reduce the $4,953 for inflation by $4,000. So that would almost eliminate all the inflationary increases. And clearly, this will have an effect on the agency, but they will have to reevaluate their purchases in light of this reduction, perhaps look at other sources or suppliers or what have you in order to manage within that. But that is our third recommendation. By the way, in my written discussion here, under the third recommendation, the second paragraph there, I apologize, that it should not be in there. I was changing another document, and I forgot to delete that. The second paragraph under number three.
It doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Okay. No, I apologize. Didn't proof it. And the final recommendation we have is that you eliminate or remove, reduce $5,322 of general fund, which is in the budget to fund temporary appointments. Last session, the agency personnel level was reduced from 5 FTE full-time equivalents to 4 FTE. And this was a fairly substantial reduction, and there was concern that under peak periods of time, the agency with its reduced staffing level would not be able to deal with the peak workloads. And the legislature put in some money to allow them to hire temporary workers during this period. But it turns out that the agency has not had to do that and does not anticipate spending funds for that purpose. So we recommend, again in the interest of meeting available revenues, that you take this $5,322 general fund out of their budget. The legislative fiscal office recommended budget then includes $14,790 in reductions in general fund from the governor's level, $193 in other funds, those are attorney general charges that are charged to other funds, and this represents a 2.1% reduction in general fund from the Governor's recommended budget.
We heard the recommendations. Can we go ahead and have some comments? Senator Crow is recognized.
Yeah. That, just with both item 3 and item 4, just want the agency to respond in a second. That's going to do any major damage.
Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, inflation is, as we all know, is a kind of a soft number. You never know exactly where it's going to be. And certainly we will do our best and we will hope that inflation won't be any greater than what it's anticipated to be. I don't believe in... Regarding number 4, the funding for temporary appointments, I don't believe that that will be a severe detriment to our ability to operate. And on that subject, if I may, just point out that the position reduction that Mr. Bender referred to that resulted in the funding for the temporary appointments was initiated by the agency.
Senator Ferriola?
Well, since you package number 200, Mr. Chairman, the package for PCs.
Yes, sir.
I've just been through a bunch of this stuff, and I just like to throw a couple of concepts out there. PCs are out there for $1,600 a pop now, fully loaded, you know, the office suite and everything else.
With the 56K modems included.
Yeah, absolutely. And 15-inch power modules in packages. So I think the agency should be able to buy 4 of these PCs for $2,000 a piece. I'm sorry, about anywhere between $1,600 and $2,000 a piece. So I think they should sharpen their pencil a little bit on that one. The laser printers, you can get 600 by 600 DPI quality out of a solid jet, and they're $300. They're not $1,000. Unless there's an absolute necessity for photographic quality print, you really don't need a laser printer. So I would suggest either 2 of the less expensive printers at a savings of $300, or 1 of the printers and just use it up. Because I can't imagine what there'd be the qualitative difference that would justify a laser printer. The 2 56K modems are built in. There should be internals.
And because of your Lantastic or your LAN, your local area network, any one of them can use the local area network and use the modems at that point on whichever machine they're on and gain access to all of the other. I think your point is extremely well taken. I leaned over to Representative Messerly and told him that I just bought top-of-the-line compact computer laptop for under $1,000 with all of this stuff on it, and the laptop is the expensive end of the chain.
I guess the other thing, Mr. Chair, just 2 other observations. Email is very convenient, but every one of us in this building has so much stress on our time, we don't usually do our own email. What happens is we print out the email and do a longhand response to it when you get time to throw it in the staff tray, and then they enter it back on the system. So I would think that 1 email and internet access account for administrative staff to do the emails for the 4 computers, if this is going to the staff, would probably get the email problem solved. It won't give people access to the internet, but it certainly will solve the email problem. And furthermore, 4 emails at $150 a piece is not $1,200. It's $600. Oh, so it's biannual. There's the $1,200. So I would say if you don't need more than 1 email, you probably don't need another phone line. So there's another $1,000 off there. And then I guess the other thing is a web page. You can get web page contractors to do a job for a bid price of $5,000 pretty easily. And unless it's going to have an awful lot of bells and whistles.
I had mine done on tied into the stage for $150. So.
But that was back in Ontario too, so I dropped a little bit, but I think your point is very well taken, Senator Ferriola. And I guess that probably would respond to the concerns of the supplier too, as well. Unless you wanted us to sharpen our pencils on this right now.
Well, no, I don't, Mr. Chairman. Just the point is that I think we're standing with the information revolution taking place in the almost free fall in practice for all the equipment. But I don't know when the estimates were made. I suspect they were not made all that recently.
Last during the past
fall. November, is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, the estimate from IRMD came in I believe it was early October, and did take into account history from probably spring last year back. So I do know there has been some movement in the industry of late.
Thanks, Chairman. I guess it's just simply the idea that the information technologies have tipped over in price significantly since October last year. And if anybody's gone out there and priced this stuff, it's getting pretty reasonable. I don't wish to disempower this agency, and this already reflects some savings from the proposed. It's just that I don't think you're going to have any trouble reaching this goal at all.
I think your point is well taken, and I just with the savings that could be generated off of proper management or the implementation of the computer system, I think with the suggestions that you've made, but you're absolutely right with the local area network and I would take just one exception. You know, we buy those email addresses so that everybody and each of the three investigators, so we do call them investigators in this department, don't we?
Sure, yes.
Okay.
Two investigators.
Each of the investigators and the director would all be involved in receiving specific email relative to issues that they're involved in at that particular point. And then you've got one extra phone in for your administrative assistant. So there certainly could be some savings if there was one single address that may be city-wise and found foolish. So I appreciate your comment. Any other comments that need to be made relative to the recommendation? We have before us a recommendation from Legislative Fiscal relative to this budget, that there be a savings in total fund of $14,983, which is a reduction from the governor's budget of 2.1%. And the legislative fiscal office recommendation is $690,427 of general fund, $7,228 of other funds, and total funding for the Government Standards and Practices Commission under Senate Bill 5514 of $697,655. Is there any objections to the legislative fiscal recommendation? There being none, we'll order that to be passed to the full committee. Senator Cole, would you like to say that?
Maybe Senator Lemmer.
Senator Lemmer, are you on the full committee?
I like to be, but I'm not.
Oh, he's not.
Okay, I'll be glad to.
Okay. I would appreciate it. Thank you very much. Are there any...
Sorry, Senator Lemmer.
If you carry it to the House, let's see. Representative Messer, would you feel comfortable with that? We'll have Representative Messer to carry that to the House and Senator Cole. Or Senator Lem, would you like to carry it to the Senate?
I'd like to carry it to the Senate.
We'll have Senator Lem carry it to the Senate. With those issues handled, then we'll go ahead and stand adjourned. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
Take care.